Welcome to Our Voices, Our Future, the podcast where we amplify the voices driving change and equity within medicine and beyond. Brought to you by the Gender Equity Task Force, a committee of the American Medical Women's Association, we're here to challenge norms, break barriers, and ignite conversations that matter. I'm Megan Etsy, and in each episode, we'll bring you candid discussions with leaders, change makers, and advocates working to create a more inclusive and just world. No more silence, no more waiting. You're listening to Our Voices, Our Future. Let's get into it. Today, we are welcoming Dr. Janelle De Jesus. Dr. De Jesus is a passionate OBGYN, content creator, women's health advocate, and brand new birth mom. She completed her medical degree at Nova Southeastern University College of Osteopathic Medicine, followed by a transition year internship in Middletown, New York, and her OBGYN residency in Gainesville, Florida. She now practices in San Juan, Puerto Rico, where she combines bedside care with a broader mission, empowering women through education and advocacy. On her public platforms, Dr. De Jesus engages patients, colleagues, and the general public on topics ranging from patient autonomy and consent to social determinants of health, obstetric violence, and gynecologic pathology. She hopes to use her voice to shift the culture of women's healthcare toward greater equity, respect, and empowerment. Thanks for being here, Dr. De Jesus.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So just to start off, can you kind of share your journey in medicine and what led you to an interest in maternal health and that kind of perinatal care?
For sure. So in high school and college, it all started more so with an interest in the sciences, anatomy and physiology, how the body works. For me, it was super interesting to see how the body is able to literally just keep itself alive for such a long period of time. And seeing how the body works both in health and in disease, how, you know, a tiny little cancer cell can grow to potentially cause so much damage. So that kind of piqued my interest in medicine overall. In medical school, I had no idea what specialty I wanted to go into. Ironically, I was completely uninterested in OBGYN. They put a C-section on the big screen in medical school, and I was like, oh, not this. Yeah. This is not it. And then I went to an ACOG conference. That's the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. And I did a bunch of simulations and practice, or you know, simulations for deliveries, ultrasound procedures. And I just absolutely loved how hands-on it was. And when I started my clinical rotations, I just fell in love with the patient population. The things that came to kind of attract me the most was the fact that, you know, when it came to delivering babies, for instance, it was the only potentially good reason that you're going to be in a hospital setting, which was awesome. And it is such a universal, but still such an intimate and mysterious part of so many people's lives. And I knew I wanted to be a part of that. Each delivery felt like, oh my God, you were winning a Super Bowl or something. Yeah. I loved being able to also follow patients from like their first period to their first baby, to perimenopause, to menopause, and everything in between. Most patients kind of feel like close friends, or almost like they can be my best friend. Yeah. And honestly, that's something that I feel like is so unique to this specialty specifically. And then later on, I came to fall in love with like the advocacy aspect, the fact that, you know, sadly, there's still so much work to be done within the realm of like women's health, and in terms of pharmaceutical and diagnostic research, patient advocacy, maternal morbidity and mortality, obstetric violence, like you mentioned. And those are things that I can talk about all day. And I knew I wanted to be a part of, you know, improving that, improving those metrics and you know, improving women's lives in turn.
It's incredible. So from your experience and the path you've had, how would you describe the current state of the pre and peri and postpartum care that we have in the United States right now?
It's abysmal. It's abysmal. And having experienced, I mean, I knew having experienced it as a physician, I knew how difficult it was for, you know, myself and my colleagues kind of like navigating it. But having also experienced it just recently from a personal standpoint, I just had my baby 7 weeks ago now.
Wow.
And yeah, and experiencing it from the patient's end was just, it was a completely different experience. I really thought I knew, but yeah, it's tough, and for a myriad of reasons. To start, insurance issues amongst both the patient side and the physician side, compensation of maternity care as a whole indirectly cuts the time for prenatal visits. So this is going to give clinicians minimal time to address questions, concerns, pathologies, follow-up plans for a lot of very high-risk pregnancies. Doesn't give us a lot of time to obtain consent in the proper way, so that, in other words, so that the patient understands, what we're talking about. And then from a physician standpoint, our average time with the patient is anywhere from 10 to 30 minutes, usually on the lower end of that, and sometimes even less. So that's going to give us minimal time really to address all of that, which further leads to issues down the line with patient trust, adherence to treatment plans, that sort of thing. And then in today's day and age, we have so much information that is openly accessible to the patient. Unfortunately, it's not all correct information or truthful information or information that is evidence-based. And so I would argue that we need even more time to kind of combat that, build a sense of trust, and rapport with our patients so that they're able to make these informed decisions. So, really, it's us against the clock, us against insurance companies, us against a lot of misinformation online. And unfortunately, a lot of patients have been traumatized by obstetric violence and having procedures done on them where they weren't properly consented, and they've been traumatized by it, and rightfully so. That does form, their experience or their perception of obstetricians. So there's a lot of work to be done internally, both, myself and my colleagues on that end as well.
I think we've kind of hit on the next question, but if you have anything else to add, what would you say some of the biggest challenges for patients during pregnancy and after childbirth, and where do you kind of see the gaps that are within care?
No, definitely. I think one of the biggest gaps that I see is just an overall lack of resources. One of the things that I see very, very often is that a lack of resources can sometimes be simply disguised as like postpartum depression. Like a patient will come into the office, she's really, really sad, she doesn't have a whole lot of help. She doesn't have the ability maybe to come to all of her postpartum appointments in spite of all of the issues that she's having. And she writes on her questionnaire that she's feeling all types of sadness, and she's not sleeping well, and she's not eating well. And she doesn't have a whole lot of help, for whatever reason. And many times that, she meets the criteria for postpartum depression, a lot of the times this lack of resources gets kind of disguised as postpartum depression, but they're not necessarily the same thing. One can lead to the other, surely. I can't argue that, but at times these things can be completely isolated issues. One is treated with a medication, and the other one doesn't necessarily need to be every single time. And then other challenges, I would say, affordable health care, of course, Medicaid. Almost 50% of deliveries that happen or patients that we're seeing are actually Medicaid patients. Affordable child care. I mean, I'm looking at child care myself, and it's like in certain states, it's like a rent, basically. Access to mental health, of course, pelvic floor physical therapy. I mean, you go get a knee replacement, and the first place you're going to get sent is physical therapy. I don't understand why, delivering a baby anywhere from 5 to 10 pounds doesn't warrant the same thing. And then contraceptive counseling, of course. 50% of pregnancies are actually unplanned, and many of those happen in the almost the immediate postpartum period.
Oh, wow. So, kind of
Yeah.
building off of those challenges you see, how would you say social determinants of health, like race, socioeconomic status, geographic location, kind of impact the maternal outcomes that we have?
So this one is a really, really tough topic, in part because I think that there are many populations and many demographics that can look at objective data and still deny that this is an issue. But we do have pretty well documented literature that states that these social determinants of health impact maternal outcomes, that race, systemic racism is still affecting maternal outcomes. Access to care and geographic location is also a huge issue plaguing the country right now. Labor and delivery units are shutting down all over the place, which essentially will leave people without care, without a place to deliver their babies. Where I attended residency, we had people traveling up to 2 hours just to come to a hospital to be able to give birth. I've worked out in, rural areas of New Mexico, and people would have to take helicopters and planes over to, either the next facility or in Texas, just to be able to see, for instance, a high-risk specialist. And of course, these lead to delays in care, delays in management, and can sometimes lead to very catastrophic, results within the pregnancy. Definitely, all of these things play into maternal outcomes in this country.
So, could you share with us kind of an example of a program, policy, or initiative that you've seen successfully improve pre- and postpartum care?
Yeah, so my favorite one, and I'm so proud of California, even though I'm not Californian and I don't claim anything Californian. However, the California Maternity Quality Care Collaborative, CMQCC is what it's called. Essentially, what this was a state, or what it is, it was a statewide initiative where they wanted to implement very standardized protocols, and trainings and simulations and things like that in order, and as well as collecting data for outcomes. In order to be able to see how they were doing in terms of improving maternal morbidity and mortality. And this was a huge, huge deal because they found that from the years 2006 to I think it was 2013, they saw a 50% decrease in maternal mortality while the
Wow.
rest of the country's rates were actually on the rise. The reason this is such a big deal is because in all of the developed nations, the United States is actually one of, if not the highest, in maternal morbidity and mortality. I think I read in, as far as statistics is concerned, we have more women who die in childbirth, than police officers. On active duty police officers here in the United States. That's a big deal. That's basically saying it's more risky to give birth in the United States than to be in a police officer in the active line of duty. The CMQCC, essentially what it did was it set, a huge example, and it displayed the importance of, having these systems in place in order to decrease morbidity and mortality. And, in my opinion, the rest of the states should follow suit. Many hospitals in different states nationwide have kind of followed their example. I know the hospital from my residency program kind of adapted a lot of the things from that quality initiative. And yeah, many hospitals have seen a decline in morbidity and mortality as a result of implementing a lot of those systems.
So, how would you say that health providers, as like a single person, and then institutions as a whole, can adapt to kind of better support patients with mental and physical health when these women are in their postpartum period?
Yeah, so postpartum, honestly is a really difficult. I mean, I'm going through it right now, so I
Yeah.
can say this. If this is the hill I would die on, but it's a really difficult time because we as physicians, I don't necessarily think that it's just a healthcare kind of thing. It's such a unique aspect of medicine and healthcare as a whole, because it's not just healthcare that happens after that, right? Like your life has changed forever. But it's a hard time because we as healthcare providers, we tend to fixate on the medical aspect, you know, your postpartum hemorrhage, your severe preeclampsia, those sorts of things. When postpartum really is so much more than that, obviously. This is where I think the lines get blurred a lot. So for example, like I mentioned before, there's just this notorious lack of resources, which, in an ideal world, I would love to see more of these things implemented that are able to kind of allow for these resources to be more accessible outside of the realm of healthcare, things, and within healthcare as well, things like more affordable child care, insurance coverage for wider aspects of postpartum, not just your postpartum visit. I mean, that just goes in the global fee or whatever, but you know, pelvic floor therapy for longer chronic issues like, you know, painful intercourse after delivery or pelvic organ prolapse or incontinence, or these issues are very, very common. And mental health, things like lactation counseling, which I'm learning firsthand, breastfeeding is not easy, pumping is not easy, and that in and of itself is enough to take a toll on like your mental health. And so I think that it's more all-encompassing, and until we acknowledge that postpartum is more than just a relationship with your obstetrician, I think until we can acknowledge that, it's not going to improve.
So, what role would you say advocacy, education, and community engagement could play in improving this pre and postpartum care for women?
So we, like I said, we won't get better outcomes without acknowledging that there's a problem, like to begin with. So we need to have these conversations. We need to be less afraid to critique both each other, like, you know, colleagues, physicians, healthcare clinicians overall. And we need to be able to critique ourselves. We need to be able to kind of question our own practices and ask ourselves whether or not they're affecting our patients in a way that's healthy and positive and uplifting, which is fine, which is why, honestly, I find myself on social media, you know, engaging in these conversations with both my colleagues and my patients all over the country. Because if we don't have these conversations, then we're not gonna get anywhere. And so that is both advocacy and education for me, just because I'm seeing so much misinformation on social media. People will find misinformation, and my stance is that if people will find misinformation on social media, I also need to be on social media so people can find information and
Yeah.
education there as well. So definitely. And community engagement, of course, you know, the only points of view that I see are from the perspectives that I have had as a patient, those of my patients. But honestly, actually, content creation as a whole, not only did I do it for advocacy, but I also wanted to be able to hear from the stories of people all across the United States to be able to talk about these experiences. It's really interesting because sometimes people will kind of almost, I don't want to say trauma dump. Sometimes they do,
Yeah.
but a lot of people will kind of like share these horrific experiences that I would never imagine are actually still happening in this country. And you know, as I alluded to before, we have to be able to acknowledge that these things are still an issue. The history of obstetrics and gynecology in and of itself is not a pretty one. It's one that at times, you know, we've made a lot of advances, but at times, you know, it's hard to be proud of. And so and some of those elements kind of weave themselves into still the care that we give today can sometimes be a little bit paternalistic in nature. So we definitely need to keep having those conversations.
So just as a whole, what like general piece of advice would you give to either aspiring physicians or healthcare professionals who want to make that meaningful impact in maternal health?
Yeah, no, the one thing I would say is that we have to keep making noise, especially within the realm of women's health. If it took patients posting on TikTok about their experiences with IUD insertions in order to change, guidelines for pain control for IUD insertions and office procedures as a whole, that's proof that, silence and complicity does not elicit any sort of change. And sometimes it's in the most unexpected ways that you're able to kind of make waves. Now there are a lot of conversations centering around, the Women's Health Initiative and why it's so important to have studies centered around women specifically as a patient population as a whole, because we make up 50% of the population, but when it comes to the research, we are still the minority. And that definitely plays a role as well, and we have to acknowledge that. So we have to make noise ultimately. If we don't know it's a problem and we can't acknowledge that it's there, there's no way we're going to be able to fix it or improve it.
And we're here, and that's why we're doing things like these podcasts, and you have your social media. Yeah, I love it. Thank you so much for this talk today. It's been very nice.
Of course, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so that's a wrap on this episode of Our Voices, Our Future. We hope today's conversation inspired you, challenged you, and reminded you the power of raising your voice. The fight for equity doesn't stop here. Join us in the movement. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and if you love this episode, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Until next time, stay bold, stay vocal, and keep the conversation going. This is Our Voices, Our Future.